Where is Cerise? Hello, my name is Tommy Gwynn. I'm the brother of Angela Cerise Gwynn Stevens. Cerise went missing October 1st of 1993. 2014, the Raleigh County Commission declared my sister deceased. Now, as of October 1st in 2025, in the next 90 days, I am offering a $50,000 reward for my sister's skeletal remains. It's none of my business how anybody goes about it. That's between you and law enforcement. I do have a special message for my sister's ex-husband, Norman Stevens. There are some people that would like to talk to you, Norman. A lot of us believe you can help us find Cerise. We'd appreciate it if you'd step out and talk to us. I would like everyone to see this, to please share it everywhere. Help bring my sister home. Thank you.
Hey, y'all, I'm Dan, and I host a podcast called Kinfolk, Stories of Community and Connection. I talk with folks from all over Appalachia, artists, small business owners, local legends, you name it. We share real stories about what brings us together, what keeps us going, and all the magic tucked away in these hills. If you're into small town charm, big hearts, and good conversation, come hang out with me on Kinfolk. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Mountain State Mysteries contains mature themes and discussions that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. All individuals mentioned in this episode are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hey, y'all. I'm your host, Mark Covey.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is Mountain State Mysteries. The case we have for you today could honestly be a Lifetime movie. It had everything from a happy marriage to a death that no one ever saw coming. This is the case of Jerry Ray Stone. For most of his life, Jerry Ray Stone seemed to be a walking poster for his business, Dr. Feelgood's Emporium, which was a store that specialized in erotic paraphernalia and tattoo art, which, Court, I know you know where it used to be in Beckley, so you want to tell everyone?
So, at the very end of New River Drive, where Kim Williams Auto Body Shop is where Dr. Feelgood's sex store was.
Pretty much.
I mean, that's the best way to put it. It was a sex store. I never knew that they'd done tattoos in there.
Me neither. I was so shocked when I saw that. I'm like, Courtney told me they had car washes here, not tattoo shops.
Yeah, I don't think that's the place I want to get a tattoo at.
I don't know why. So the owner, Jerry, was known as a happy-go-lucky guy who let nothing get him down. But come February of 1998, that all changed when he married 25-year-old Andrea Marie Ryder, better known as Andy. Not too long after this, the two settled down in their home on New River Drive, which wasn't too far from Dr. Feelgood's. It wasn't too long after this that the marriage started to suffer.
I wonder why, like, how, if everything was going so good, why it would turn so quickly.
Apparently, there was a lot of fear and jealousy from Jerry. Like, he was worried that younger competition would get to Andy.
I can see that.
Which he had a difficult past. He urged her to seek professional help. Even though their arguments were intense, he was convinced that she loved him and he knew what was best for her. If he could just keep her out of trouble until she matured and got her head straightened out, he knew the marriage could survive. Over the past year, he had several confrontations with her ex-boyfriend. The two had broken up shortly before she married Jerry, and Joe seemed determined to rekindle their romance. Jerry finally had enough and had to go to Joe's house and threaten physical harm if Joe didn't stay away from his wife.
In reality, even though like everything looked good on the inside, it was a really difficult time on the inside that folks couldn't see.
Yeah, it's been like a hard year for the couple. It was said that Jerry had good plans for April 30th. Jerry had a lot of friends and he was known for being good to him. He learned that April 30th was the 32nd birthday of one of his employees, Chuck Belcher. Jerry sent another employee, Buddy Dixon, out to buy a birthday cookie while he traveled to his home to get a bottle of champagne.
He sounds really caring to go out of his way to get a birthday cookie for someone.
Yeah, like when I was typing this, I'm like, could have been the cookie company at the mall. But then I'm like, I don't think it was there at the time.
Oh, yeah.
It was?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, then it was probably a good birthday cookie then.
Yeah. And also, too, going home to get a bottle of champagne.
Yeah, I mean, popping the good stuff.
He knew how to party.
And he found out that Chuck never tried champagne before. So he thought it would be the perfect way to start a birthday celebration.
The small group toasted Chuck with styrofoam cups filled with champagne and laughed as he opened his gifts. By 9:30 p.m., the partygoers drifted away to return to their homes. Did I ever tell you about the time that a wedding that occurred at my house and I drank 5 Red Solo cups full of champagne?
Was that the time someone was like crawling in your yard?
Oh, that was me.
Oh.
So Jerry made it clear that he planned to finish off a second bottle of champagne after he got home. Andy warned him not to drink too much because he was not supposed to mix alcohol with the prescription he was taking of Valium. The friends bid farewell to each other without any warning that it would be their final farewell for Jerry.
Hey y'all, I'm Elisa.
And I'm Samantha.
And welcome to Watch for Deer Podcast. We're a couple of best friends from Southern West Virginia, and around here, Watch for Deer is our way of saying we love you and be safe.
This is a conversational podcast that covers many topics from A to Z, including, but not limited to, true crime and the paranormal. Our goal is to bring you an episode a week, so come listen as we tell stories that will make you laugh and maybe even blow your mind. Y'all be safe,
and watch for deer.
When Deputy Dave Stafford responded to an emergency call to the Stone residence on New River Drive on the night of April 30th, 1999, the situation seemed to be an unfortunate but all too common one. He arrived at the home to find 54-year-old Jerry lying dead on the couch.
That's just so weird. Like, how long was he even laying there?
Honestly, I'm not too sure, but I know his body was cool to the touch, with blood pooling and rigor starting to set in.
Also, do you know rigors? Like, it'll set, release.
Mm-hmm. There's like different stages of it.
Yeah, I think there's like 7 stages of rigors.
Mm-hmm.
Was anybody else in the house with him when Deputy Stafford showed up?
Yeah, Charles Belcher was actually there with Andy, and, you know, they were there when Stafford and Jankare showed up.
And do they exactly know what happened?
Not exactly. Andy said that she got out of the shower to see her husband unconscious on the couch. According to her, he was drinking heavily throughout the day and mixing alcohol with drugs. She said that while she was in the shower, he got up from the couch and taken some of her prescription Xanax.
If she was in the shower, how does she know he took the prescription of Xanax unless she counted and knew exactly?
You know, I wish I had that answer for you. The only thing that I could find is that she wasn't in the shower at the time, but she was later on. I do know that Charles could add a little bit more information to the situation. He was working when she called him around 11:45 p.m. and asked him to come to the house. He arrived to find Jerry had fallen in the floor and was too intoxicated to get back up on the couch without assistance. Charles helped his employer onto the couch, but he was concerned about Jerry's condition. He seemed like he was more than just intoxicated. He didn't respond sensibly to any question, and he pointed into the distance as if he was hallucinating. Charles recommended that Andy called an ambulance.
Did she do it?
Not right then and there. She insisted that Jerry was just drunk and that, you know, he would be fine after he sobered up. Charles returned to work. And after this, Andy argued with Jerry for a few moments. And then she went to lay in a tanning bed and, you know, take her shower. Following her shower, that's when she found Jerry still on the couch. As she bent to kiss him on the forehead, she saw the prescription bottle lying on the floor beside the couch. She shook him and got no response, so she kicked him in an effort to wake him up.
Like, did she kick him hard like you would a soccer ball, or just like a normal little kick?
You know, I don't know. I've never dealt with someone who was unconscious before to know if I would, you know. I don't think I would kick him like a soccer ball. But I don't think I would kick him at all. I think I would, like, turn him over and see, you know, if they were breathing or whatever. Like, then I think I would rush and call 911. I think in all honesty, she panicked. But after she did that, she turned him over and realized that he wasn't breathing. She rushed out of the house to get Charles, who ended up calling 911.
In a weird way, it does seem like it would be an open and shut case. I mean, you're mixing alcohol with prescription drugs.
You think that. However, when the Raleigh County Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Tanner, learned of Jerry's death, he wasn't ready to dismiss it as an overdose. I mean, he's known Jerry for almost 17 years and didn't think he would ever be a victim of an overdose. Sure, Jerry was a heavy drinker, but he wasn't known to abuse narcotics. Tanner was convinced that there was more to the death of Dr. Feelgood.
On May 2nd, Tanner set out to interview the employees of Dr. Feelgood, who had been at the party. He learned that the drinking party was nothing more than friends splitting a bottle of champagne to toast a birthday. The bottle had been divided into styrofoam cups, with each person only finishing one. Tanner estimated that Jerry had not had more than about 6 ounces of champagne at the party. In all honesty, it's not a whole lot of anything. That's like a double going into a shot of liquor, so.
In addition, Charles, who was the last person other than Andy to see Jerry alive, has his own perception of his death. He was sure that the bottle of medication had not been lying on the floor beside the couch, and he didn't think that Jerry was in any condition to, like, stand up and go get it.
I mean, in all honesty, Charles is starting to make really good sense.
I mean, exactly. He said that he would have been too intoxicated to remove the child protection cap anyway.
Long story short, he would have been shit-faced.
Pretty much. That's how Charles is, you know, just taking it. Like, someone's too drunk to do anything and just needs to sober up. But you want to know something else Charles said?
I sure do.
He said that he stepped out of the store to take the trash out that night and he saw Andy calmly walking the street.
Huh?
Yeah, he said that she had no panic to her or even any concern until she saw him there, and then she rushed up and began telling him the story that she told Stafford the night before. Now, something kept telling Lieutenant Tanner that something was just off with this case. During the interview, he noticed that although the house was in total disarray and the sink was filled with dirty dishes, two champagne glasses were actually washed and they were air drying in the sink.
So it sounds like Andy's only concern was getting those two glasses washed.
Yeah, like it makes no sense.
None.
Unless she was trying to hide something or just wanted to hurry and wash them. But to me, that's still weird. Like, why not just do all of the dishes? As the days passed, other actions of hers were not your typical grieving wife, especially on the day of Jerry's funeral. She began a sexual affair with one of the employees of Dr. Feelgood's.
Oh yes, she sounds like such a grieving widow.
Right, and like, it gets even better. The employee later told investigators that she confessed to him that she killed her husband.
So, did she say that she just did it, or did she go into detail?
Oh, homegirl went into full detail. She said that she placed the Xanax in his mouth and washed him down with wine while he still gurgled in his sleep. She put a trash bag over his mouth and then smothered him with a pillow. When she was sure he was dead, she went to go take her shower.
Hi, I'm Shane.
I'm Hannah.
And we're Country Roads Creeps. We're a podcast that covers all manner of creepy, spooky stories, from cryptids and conspiracies to unexplained deaths and disappearances to mysterious and paranormal happenings in the world.
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and pretty much anywhere you listen to podcasts. Check out our Facebook page and our Instagram account at Country Roads Creeps for photo dumps and more information we'll post with every episode.
If you enjoy the show, please feel free to share us with your friends and leave us a 5-star review. And if there's any topics that you'd like to hear us cover in the future, feel free to message us on our social media accounts. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. Well, be safe driving home and watch out for the not deer.
Bye.
Bye.
Andy's story fits what was found during the autopsy, but the evidence was not so clear-cut. All police has so far was this hearsay testimony of an ex-boyfriend. It was not nearly enough for a conviction.
One thing that shocks me is that Andy continued to behave unlike a true grieving widow. She took a series of lovers and continued her partying lifestyle. Police did learn that she started to give away Jerry's possessions before the funeral even started.
For the life of me, that is something I will never fully comprehend. Mm-hmm. Never. Oh yes, here I am in the middle of grief. Here, would you like this watch?
Literally, like I... No.
Like it don't make no sense.
No, it makes like no sense at all.
So like when my grandmother passed... Right before the service, my grandfather got all the granddaughters together and he gave us each a ring that we could pick out of my grandmother's. And I asked for one specific ring and he said that one's already been claimed because it was amazing. It was like this moon star. It was like a moon star sapphire or something like that. I forget what it was. And it had diamonds all around it. Like, it was amazing and everything. But other than that, like, no, nothing else was given away. Nothing. But he just wanted to make sure all the granddaughters got a ring.
So, like, I have no idea. Like, to me, you have to be a cold-hearted big give stuff away before your husband is even in the ground.
It kind of makes you wonder, like, what exactly she would give away.
Well, the day after his death, she gave away a stereo system to two employees as a bribe to help her continue the business. She took any money she could get access to and placed it into a trust in the name of her daughter, Alabama. Then she convinced a friend to help her break into several small safes in Jerry's home to look for money. Behind the scenes, Tanner was working in the background. He interviewed everyone connected to Andy. Time and time again, he heard that she confessed to Jerry's murder. It's like she couldn't keep her mouth shut about what she did.
You know what cracks me up about all this stuff? You remember when we went... last year to the thing at the Clay Center. Mm-hmm. And the guy told us that somebody who confesses a murder is either going to tell everybody that they did it or they're going to show them mm-hmm. what they did because it's so much guilt mm-hmm. brought upon them.
And like, that's one thing I couldn't wrap my head around, like coming up with this, like she basically told it with like no regret whatsoever.
Yeah. And, no ifs given.
Yeah, and I mean, it was more than a confession. It was like she was boasting about, like she was proud of herself for doing it.
Oh my God, I killed Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah, so Tanner, being the amazing lieutenant he is, he recorded every single detail and followed every single lead. In September of 2003, Tanner was ready to provide the evidence for a grand jury hearing. The charge made by prosecutors was clear and chilling. And court, I have it in the document. Can you read it?
Yeah. Quote, Andrea Marie Stone did on April 30th, 1999, give her husband Jerry Ray Stone a cocktail of champagne and approximately 12 pills of her prescription Xanax. The pills were 0.5 milligrams in size. This resulted in an intention overdose and the death of Jerry Ray Stone, end quote.
I mean, the evidence against Andy was compelling, but it was too late.
What do you mean too late?
Well, by the time the grand jury convened to hear the case, Andy had disappeared and her whereabouts were unknown.
Oh my God, I swear, nothing irritates me more than, oh my God, well, we're going to wait. You know good and well that they're going to run.
Yeah.
God bless.
But Tanner was lucky enough to trace her through three states and three name changes and another husband. And all I can tell from my research is that she moved on and left the disappointment and her murder legacy in Beckley. If you have any information on the murder of Jerry Ray Stone, please contact the West Virginia State Police at 304-872-0800. We'll be back next week with a brand new case. If you find yourself enjoying Mountain State Mysteries, take a second to follow, download, and rate the show on your favorite podcast platform. It helps others find good West Virginia true crime podcasts.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Mountain State Mysteries.
Do you have a case you want us to cover? Send us an email at mountainstatemysteries304@gmail.com.
For the show notes, check out our website, mountainstatemysteriespodcast.com.